Station number 14128, Frederick Parham, Reel 1.
Something like 7 years ago, I was asked whether I would give an account of my life in the Royal Navy to the Elsted Women's Institute. And after some hesitation, I said that I would. And I actually got up to speak in the village hall on the 14th of April, 1969. I explained that I really rather regretted ever since I agreed to do it. Not because of the homework involved, all of which had to come out of my head. I had nothing in writing to refer to. And I've enjoyed wallowing in nostalgia, but I was afraid that my audience might be bored. To me, the whole of my time in the Royal Navy was interesting and thrilling and happy. Lots of very hard work and lots of fun. But by some standards, it might have been considered rather dull. For example, believe it or not, I have never crossed the line. I explained that I obviously hadn't had time to prepare a flowing narrative, so I made a few notes to which I'm referring now. However, I said, you've asked for it, and so here it is, entitled Mostly the Lighter Side of 45 Years in the Royal Navy, which I said I hoped wouldn't last more than the 55 minutes which I was allowed. In fact, it took me about an hour to get halfway through what I'd noted down. I was asked if I would appear again a second time and finish the thing off. I must confess, I thought it had all gone down very well, and the president of the WI said she was very pleased with it all. But in fact, I was never asked to do the thing again, which I must confess really did rather hurt, and still does. But as a very dear Admiral under whom I once served, Sir Robert Burnett, used to say, these little things are sent to keep us humble. Well, here we start. I made up my mind quite definitely to join the Royal Navy when I was 6 years old. My father had died when I was 5 years old, and so of course had no influence on me in that way. And looking back, there's no doubt about it that I was led towards wanting to join the Royal Navy by a very dear uncle of mine, the husband of one of my father's sisters, to whom I was devoted, and he himself was a naval officer. The age of entry at that time was 12 and a half years. You went up for an interview, which was pretty terrifying at that age, followed by a written examination. Well, I passed in, and I joined the Royal Naval College, Osborne, in September 1913. It was a fairly taut routine. You move mostly at the double. You never, never put your hands in your trouser pockets. In fact, you couldn't, because there weren't any pockets in your trousers. And things I remember in the dormitories particularly were organized entirely by ringing gongs. There was a gong for you to say your prayers, and a gong for you to get undressed, and a final gong, no, a semi-final gong to brush your teeth, and finally a gong to which you hopped into bed. It was a fairly good, I think, general education, though time had to be found above the ordinary line of education for seamanship, boats, engineering, etc. But it was not true to say that we only learnt naval history. My dear wife, I remember, said once that at Osborne, our scripture instruction referred solely to Noah and the Ark and Jonah. But that was not true. At the end of the summer term of 1914, First War broke out. The Royal Naval College Dartmouth was empty to all cadets who all went off to sea, and our time was cut from 6 and 6 terms to 5 terms at Osborne and 5 at Dartmouth. So I finished my Dartmouth training at Christmas 1916 and went on leave to await my first appointment. The appointment arrived in January 17, on my 16th birthday, to His Majesty's ship Malaya in the 5th Battle Squadron. She was one of the Queen Elizabeth class, almost a brand new ship, the gift to the nation of the Federated Malay States. The wording of the appointment was something to the effect that I was appointed to His Majesty's ship Malaya and was directed to repair on board at Rosyth and herewith a railway warrant. But what I knew about the Navy and what my mother knew about the Navy was absolutely nil. And we'd always gone by a book produced by Gieves, the naval outfitter. It started with how you put in for a cadetship, and then how you joined Osborne, and then of course a list of all the underclothes you need, which you bought from Gieves. And finally, the very last page, which by then I'd got to, told you what to do when you got your appointment to your first ship. You wrote to your commanding officer and said, "Sir, I have the honour to submit that I've been appointed to HM ship under your command, and when shall I come?" or words to that effect. Well, that of course was written for peacetime, and somehow or other I discovered a couple of days later that what I ought to have done was to have gone off by the next possible train, which of course is exactly what I wanted to do. I was only too keen to get to sea and win the war. But anyway, off I went. My mother took me up, I remember, to King's Cross and saw me off to Edinburgh. And that, incidentally, was the last news she had of me for 10 days. I arrived alongside, and the very last thing of all that I remembered was that as I came over the side, I should salute and say, "Midshipman Parham, sir, come on board to join him." But I had no time to do that, because the commander, who was an absolute tiger, was waiting at the top of the gangway. And as I came over the side, he said to me, "Why are you late?" And I said, "Oh, sir, I didn't know, or I thought, or something." But I was cut short, and he let fly at me for what seemed like about 5 minutes, and ended up, I remember, by saying, these are his exact words, "Well, I must tell you that you've earned for yourself in advance a reputation for being a very casual young officer, and I hope you manage to live it down." Shortly after that, we went to sea, and I remember I kept the middle watch, which lasts from midnight till 4 a.m., looked after, of course, by one of the senior midshipmen, because I hadn't the foggiest idea of what was going on, and we ended up, after some days at sea, at Scarpa Flow. As I say, my mother had no news of me until I was able to get a letter to her from Scarpa Flow. Fortunately, we went on, the ship went to refit, and I had some leave, about a week or so, only 1 month later. So I was able to tell my mother a little bit more than I'd been able to tell her in my letter. And incidentally, that was the last leave I had for 11 months. We belonged to the Grand Fleet in what was called the 5th Battle Squadron. The Grand Fleet, of course, it's almost incredible to look back on it now. You think that there were 42 capital ships before you started on the cruisers and destroyers and so on. And the sight at sea, of course, was simply staggering. The fleet, as no doubt you know, was commanded by Admiral Sir John Jellicoe, the only man, as Winston Churchill said, who could have lost the war in one afternoon. And the Admiral commanding the Battle Cruiser Squadron, who were based at Rosyth as opposed to Scarpa, Well, there was David Beatty, who afterwards, of course, became Commander-in-Chief after the Battle of Jutland. The Battle of Jutland, of course, had been fought 6 months before, and after that, there was no more fighting for the Grand Fleet. I mean, there was plenty of actions went on from Harriet and Dover and so on, but the Grand Fleet saw no more action. We longed for it, of course, in our ignorance, I suppose. And I remember now the excitement, if you've been ashore for a walk or something, if you came back and saw smoke pouring out of the funnels, and it looked as if the ship was as if the fleet was raising steam to go to sea. But in fact, I never saw the German fleet until it surrendered on the 21st of November 1918. One of the most remarkable things, I suppose, that's ever happened in naval history. As a matter of interest, among the officers in the Madeira was a young lieutenant, Prince Albert, afterwards King George VI. Midshipman's life alternated very considerably between quite reasonably responsible jobs in connection with action and lots of instruction and lots of being chased about and pulling boats and so on. I remember one of the things that I found awfully difficult was that every letter I wrote home I knew was going to be read by somebody else, the censor. But we had the chief censor in the ship was our padre, a fellow named Matthews, a temporary naval chaplain, one of the nicest chaps that ever was. But a very nice story about him. We had a lieutenant commander in the ship who was a little apt to indulge in the bottle. And one evening, the commander thought he'd got him, and he managed to persuade the captain to court-martial him for being drunk on board. And at the court-martial, the padre was called as a witness, and he was asked the question, on the evening in question, did you notice anything unusual in the behavior of the accused? And the padre, who couldn't bear to say anything unkind about anybody, but at the same time, of course, could never speak anything but the truth, said, well, I must say I did think it was a little odd when the president tapped the table for grace and the accused knelt down. Well, there wasn't, of course, very much of interest to take us ashore at Scarpa, but we... The morale of the fleet was kept up by things like, quite particularly, theatricals. Most of them, of course, were fairly light-hearted musical plays. But we in the Malaya, we had our commander, not the one who met me when I arrived, a new one. The commander was really a very brilliant actor, and we acted a play called The Lion's Mail, in which H.B. Irving and Ellen Terry, I think it was, had almost made their names. And I, as a dear little midshipman, took the part which Ellen Terry took. Well, life went on, and finally, of course, came the armistice, which I remember occurred in the middle of our doing our written exams for promotion to sub-lieutenant. Then, 10 days later, came the surrender of the German fleet on the 21st of November 1918. I suppose, I think I said this before, but I suppose one of the most remarkable things that's ever happened in naval history. And shortly after that, I was promoted to acting sub-lieutenant. And I was appointed to a small, really sort of miniature destroyer, a so-called patrol boat called P-11, and I was the first lieutenant. The captain was a lieutenant, I was the second in command, and we had a warrant officer, a gunner, and an engineer officer. It's always been one of my proud boasts that I was first lieutenant to one of HM ships before I was allowed to smoke, because I wasn't quite 18 years old. We were employed, based on Dover, in post-war mine clearance, which was interesting and was financially most rewarding, because I'd been paid at the normal rate of $5 a day as a midshipman, and suddenly, because they gave very special extra pay for the chaps who were clearing mines, I leapt up to 30 shillings a day, which of course came just at the right time, because I had all my plain clothes to buy, which I had none since I was a little boy at school, and of course all my peacetime uniform. During that time, I was only there for just over 6 months, during that time my captain went sick, and I actually took temporary command of the ship at the mince age of 18 years and about 3 months. With complete, I remember complete confidence, and far, far more than I had the next time I found myself in command of a destroyer when I was a commander. Well, that came to an end, and I went home on leave, and then received an appointment to His Majesty's ship, APHIS. Well, that meant absolutely nothing to me. It said I was appointed to the APHIS, and I would be given further instructions as to my passage. So I really didn't know whether the ship was in Ireland or China, but it clearly involved some form of lengthy passage to get there. And I thought, well, now, if I didn't even know what an APHIS was, I was town bred and not very clever on gardens, and so I thought, well, if I look up in the dictionary and see what an APHIS is, I may be able to see what sort of a ship she is. For example, the minesweepers were all called after either flowers or dances and so forth. So I looked up APHIS in the dictionary and discovered to my horror that the description was vine fretter or plant louse, which didn't sound frightfully dignified and meant absolutely nothing to me. How I discovered eventually that she was in fact a shallow draft gunboat on the Danube with one other ship called the Ladybird. And I was then given instructions to go to Victoria Station, London, where I would pick up 43 sailors and 99 pieces of luggage to take out to Belgrade in what was then called Serbia, now Yugoslavia. And that's about as far as the instructions went. So I took the party down to Dover, and we got into a boat across to France, found ourselves eventually in Paris. And, oh, it's a very long story, but I forget exactly how long it took. I think about 6 days to get from Paris to Belgrade. We were not allowed to travel first class. We used to be shunted into a siding once a day while the Simplon Orient Express swept past us. And at one time, I remember, there were 44 of us and 99 pieces of luggage, all huddled together in one cattle truck. However, I won't bother with all the details, it was a very long story, but I eventually arrived at Belgrade to find that both ships had recently moved right up the river to Budapest, which was, I suppose, about something like 700 miles up the river. Well, we got there in the end, and I joined my ship to find myself one of two only officers, my captain, whom I didn't like, a fairly ancient lieutenant commander, and myself. He had a rule, I remember, that one of the two of us was always to be on board, and it was nothing for him to go ashore for 47 hours out of 48, which meant that I stayed on board for 47 hours out of 48. And it was interesting, but a bit depressing. However, he went eventually, and I got a very nice you kept him. And shortly after I went, we moved up the river into Budapest. That was the time when a Bolshevik named Béla Kun had overthrown the Hungarian government and taken command. And he used to get a rude letter from the Allies about once a week to tell him that it really was time he went. That's quite wrong. He was thrown out of Budapest by the Romanians, who of course were on our side, and it was they who, having got into Budapest, thought it was a splendid place to be in, and they stripped the place of all that they could find, including, I was told, even the ropes from the which worked the lifts in the hotels, eventually came the great day when they were to go. And I happened to be ashore on duty in Budapest at the Pest end of one of the bridges, the Elizabeth Bridge, I think it was. And I actually saw Admiral Horthy arrive at the head of his white guard. Nothing more theatrical, I think, I'd ever seen, with their jingling bits and harness and all this splendid Hungarian uniform of the Hungarian hussars. And there he was, of course, until, as the regent, Hungary, by then having broken away from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, until the Second War started. Well, then we went down to a little place called Novi Sad in Yugoslavia. It had been a dear little town in Hungary called Wiedek in Hungarian, or Neusatz in German, but it had been turned over to the Serbs by the peace treaty, who let it go absolutely to rack and ruin. It was difficult there in a way, because the Serbs, who of course were the most splendid fighters, were not our sort of natural companions. We were much more friendly with the original inhabitants of the place, the Hungarians. However, we got on. I got to know a Hungarian family there very well and used to go up and see them very, very often. There were three daughters in the family who spoke five languages absolutely perfectly and had never left their own country. They took me in hand to give me some German lessons, I remember, and we started off very correctly with things like Ich habe, du hat, hat, and der, die, das, and that sort of thing, until we got bored with that, and they said they'd teach me some useful phrases in German, one of which I remember to this day, which was Sie haben ein hübsches Grübchen, which means you've got the most glorious little dimple. Well, that came to an end, and after very nearly a year up there, we were ordered back to Malta to refit, and so we went right down the river, out into the Black Sea, paused for a moment in Constantinople, and then went on to Malta via the Corinth Canal. We had to be very careful, because these little gunboats only drew 2 or 3 feet in draft, and we had to be very careful not to be committed to any stormy passages. In fact, we were from the Corinth Canal to Malta escorted all the way by a destroyer. And after we got to Malta, I left the ship and came home. Shortly after I got home, I was appointed with a very large number of my contemporaries and sub-lieutenants to University of Cambridge. The normal procedure for sub-lieutenants in peacetime had been that they went first of all to the Royal Naval College, Greenwich, and then on to their short courses in the various specializations, gunnery, torpedo, navigation, and engineering. But at that time, the Royal Naval College, Greenwich, had not been reopened. It had been closed during the war, and so we were sent up to Cambridge University, which was an extremely interesting experience. Of course, right outside one's normal life. The only error which I think they made was that they made us wear uniform whenever the undergraduates wore cap and gown, which apart from being a frightful bore, because it meant sometimes that you might have to change your clothes three or four times a day, was a great mistake because it picked us out as being rather sort of unusual creatures, whereas one of the great points of going to Cambridge was that we should become ordinary people and mix with ordinary people and try to forget the Navy for a little bit. However, I then went on from there to do my courses at Portsmouth in gunnery, etc. And having completed courses, was promoted to lieutenant. So seniority as lieutenant depended on what class of passing out marks you got in the various courses you did. And I was appointed to the war spike in what was then called the Atlantic Fleet, later known as the Home Fleet. The war spike was always a splendid and happy ship. I don't know why the ships get that reputation sometimes, and they keep it. And I had a very happy 2 years in the war spike. Please note I say in the war spike, and not, as you might say, on the war spike. My dear old uncle, who I told you about, who inspired me to join the Navy, used to say, "Do you live on a house?" Well, that issue was a very happy job. I had many jobs. I was kept extremely busy, including, of course, officer watch at sea and in harbour. I really had, for 2 years, jolly few complete nights in my bunk. And, I won't go into the question of what the officer watch did, but we used to move about, of course, nothing, never less than the squadron was, say, four battleships, and you had to keep an exact station on your next ahead and so on. And there were all sorts of fun in the mess. Like, we were particularly good in that ship at charades. I also, for my sins, ran a concert party. I don't think it was a frightfully good one, but it seemed to go down all right. And I remember one stoker who sang a song which really almost brought tears to the eyes and was an absolute roaring success. And I remember the chorus of it, which went, when the swallows build their nests, sweet Murray, when the honeysuckle sighs for the bee, far across the deep blue sea, I'll be coming back to thee. When the swallows build their nest, sweet Murray. There was also, of course, the day of what was called the comic song, and I remember only two lines of he said, "I'm not only going to produce two lines, the one comic song which was sung, which went, I like an hot water bottle hot, an hot water bottle in bed, wives may be a luxury, an hot water bottle's the thing for me." And I won't go on with that anymore.